Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here at the conference in Portland, and we will get started straight away. The session's called Strategies for Rigor, Relevance, and Reading for Struggling to Average Readers, okay? So we're trying to target a group of kids who might have some challenges, and at the same time, this is not done from the perspective of reading teachers. I'm assuming that most of you are not reading teachers, but you're content area teachers that want to enhance some of your skills in that area. Just to briefly introduce myself, I spent the first 25 years of my career as a high school social studies teacher, and I really had a very exciting time. I went through a lot of transitions in my teaching. I think very early on, I kind of gravitated to it because I had some high school social studies teachers that I liked. So I was, you know, I kind of got it. I knew what it was all about, and I was going to do that. And so I think my early teaching model was probably that of the lecturer. And I was, you know, I was good at it. And then I think at a certain point in my career, I started realizing that I could not continue to put on five shows daily. So I started to, look for ways to try and turn the learning over to the kids. The first thing I tried was just saying, okay, you're free to learn. That didn't quite work. I hear you laughing. You probably went through the same thing. But I think over time I developed, really through trial and error, some great ideas for a more student-centered classroom. And in doing so, I kept myself very interested and engaged in my own work as a teacher, which is why I stayed in the classroom as long as I did. About 25 years in, I was still having a great time, loving it, had every thought that I would just continue to be, you know, a classroom teacher. I was working on other projects, but that was the core of what I did. And the district I was working for needed someone to serve as teacher on special assignment, coordinator of social studies, K-12. Nobody wanted the job. And so finally, reluctantly, I said, okay, I'll do that. So I did that for a couple of years. Then my superintendent said, gee, you know, you should really think about going into administration. I said, you got to be kidding me. Now? Why would I do it now? I think I made some comment about not wanting to go back and take classes because I was about to turn 50. And he said, well, you're going to be 50 anyway, so you might as well take the classes. So I did. And so there I was in grad school getting some more paper along with, you know, lots of very, very young teachers. I mean, it was not, you know, most people were not my age. And that was an interesting experience. That's all I'll say about it. And I did get certified for administration, and I ended up getting hired to be an assistant superintendent of instruction in another district, which I did for 5 years. And then I retired from that position. So that's sort of my 34, 35-year teaching career, mainly teaching. Many years ago, when I decided I wasn't going to be painting houses all summer, I said, you know, I've got to get a second job that aligns with my first job, because this isn't working. So I started working with some textbook companies. I started applying for grants. I started just doing a lot of things in the educational field outside of the setting of my own classroom. Got very excited by that. I was one of the things that happened was I was recruited by Willard Daggett and the International Center for Leadership and Education to work with them as a trainer, which I did maybe about 10 years ago. I'm now one of their senior consultants. So I've had a very active career both in the classroom and working all over the country with publishers and school districts and training and consulting. So I've continued to do that now. The reason I've got my website address up here is because there's a lot of resources that are online. And in fact, this workshop, you'll find much more about what I'm talking about at the website. I get on the average school day, I get about 1,000 visitors a day who are spending about, I think it's 9.5 minutes there at the site. So I'm guessing they're mainly teachers because the visitors fluctuate along with the academic school year. And I'm probably doing more teaching now online, in effect, than I ever did in the classroom. So I think it's a great resource, and I urge you to take a look at it. Three of the sites that sort of reference the work that I'm doing here at this conference. One is this content reading strategies at work, and that neatly aligns with what we're doing. I just did a session on digital publishing, and if you're interested and want to come up, I've got all sorts of books that are published by students using new digital technology. I'm also giving that presentation tomorrow again. I'm also doing a presentation on small learning communities, specifically ninth grade academies, and you might want to stop up for that one. The other thing I would mention is if you'd like me to work with your district or any of the other organizations that you might work with, please send me an email. I work all across the country. I'd love to come back to the Pacific Northwest again. If you just want to email me with a question or comment, that's great too. It'd be nice if you put something in the title line other than low mortgage rates, because I probably will not open that email. So think of something that's going to say, I bet you this person saw me at the conference. By the way, I will be taking the handout and putting that on my blog. I'll do that later today because I keep changing these things. I think I sent this off the state out a month ago, and it's changed since then. And it'll be a color version. I'm also doing an audio tape of this, and I'll post that online so you can, if you want to subject yourself to this for another hour, you can do that. Again, these are the other workshops that I'm doing, and just to let you know, the workshop for high-performing readers is probably the one that's closest to this one, and there's probably about a 50% overlap. I mean, it's not the same, but it's pretty close. There's some parallel elements to it. The other two workshops on publishing and ninth grade academy are totally different. So if you want to come back for those, please do. Certainly the work we'll be doing in here, I think, really supports what the state's aiming at. Certainly the initiative here around Reading Next, as well as, I think, the real central issue, which is how do we build literacy strategies while we teach our content. And that's what I'm all about. I do workshops all over the country, usually with middle school and high school faculties, typically a day or two days, about just a whole host of strategies. I'm going to just give you a taste of that today. I do like to point out there is partial assembly required. I mean, we've got people of all different content areas here. We've got middle school, high school teachers. But most importantly, I hope that this will be rigorous and relevant to your craft as teachers. That says at the bottom, I need someone well-versed in the art of torture. Do you know PowerPoint? By the way, I do not read my PowerPoints. So, this is me when I got started. 1970, 71, standing up. That's what I did. I stood there and I lectured. See, I had a striped shirt then, too. Huh? I've got another one in here. Well, I won't show it to you. It's with the long hair and the beard. I was in my Loggins and Messina phase. You know, I was, like, very hairy. The tie was gone then, by the way, as you might have guessed. You know, one of the themes that I'm really getting fascinated by is this whole notion of how information moves around. See, when I started teaching, it was all about teacher as gatekeeper. You know, I've got all the information. I'm going to dole it out to you in little bits. And that really neatly matched how information moved around the rest of the society. Here was the hit movie. Here was the evening news. Here was the newspaper. I mean, that's how you got your information. Some authority somewhere curated it all for you and then said, here it is. And that's how it happened. What's happened since is we're in an information age. See, it is about information. And there are now new technologies that really put kids in control of the flow of information. See, they do not need gatekeepers anymore. Though that's gone. In fact, if you were to look at the audience for TV, film, newspaper, radio, every one of them is in steady decline. If you're worried about adequate yearly progress, you ought to be the executive at Viacom that's watching your stock tank. Because nobody's going to the movies. No, I mean, the audience for films among the young is dropping precipitously. I mean, they can still put out the blockbuster Will Ferrell movie and drag them out for a weekend, but it's not the way it used to be. And back in the old days when I first started watching TV, Gunsmoke had 70% of the audience. Today, American Idol, that we, quote, all watched, 28% of the audience had. There's just a lot of places to get information. And see, I think one of the things that's happened is this flow of information has profoundly changed the whole nature of how we interact. On one hand, it's become very personal. Kids are essentially their own researcher, their own entertainment director, their own editor. They can go get what they want when they want it. And they can TiVo it and skip through the ads. They can reformat it. They can do whatever they want with it. And secondly, this is the collaborative part. They now don't have to simply interact with the kids around them, the people that happen to live where they do. Because online, there are communities of people that are evolving around interests, around meta tags on Flickr. I mean, you name it. The entire world is being linked up. I mean, I actually, believe it or not, got a job outsourced to me from India. Honest to God, I may be the only American working for the India. It was an educational software company where they had received a contract from a major American publisher of software to develop software over there. They contacted me to send me the material and different aspects of the design phase to see if it was, quote, American enough. So it got re-outsourced back to me. But there's all sorts of people all over the world that are now interacting with each other, working in teams. So, again, personal and collaborative. Unfortunately, if I were to walk into most classrooms, I'd still see, you know, the teacher up front, the kids taking notes, and the kids raising their hands to say, can I tell you what I know? Except I don't think the kids are highly engaged by this environment anymore. So if you think what you're worrying about is no child left behind, I don't think that's what's going to change your job. What's going to change your job is your kids are not going to be engaged in that classroom that we grew up in. And when they walk in this fall, it's going to be like walking into the past for a lot of them. And so we really have to find ways to make classes more engaging and student-centered. And that's really everything that I'm here to talk about over the course of all four workshops. And all that I've really been working on is how to relinquish the responsibility for learning to kids. Because they expect a lot of functionality with information. So as teachers, we really have to see our roles as profoundly different. I mean, I hate to say this, but you're not on the mission you've signed up for. They have, as they say, repurposed you. You have a new purpose. You are now designer of a learning environment. So we really have to recognize this. There are some new realities. And another aspect I was mentioning is there's a whole equity thing here because not all kids can afford this personal technology. So for many of our kids, school is the place where they're going to learn to be a participant in this new world. And I think literacy has really been redefined in the 21st century. And I would really, borrowing heavily from David Warlick and Alan November and people like that, would really redefine literacy as the ability to find the information, decode it, evaluate it in a critical way, organize it, and share it with others. And remember, you're not going to be there to curate that information. And they can go to a website that says there was no Holocaust, and it looks just as good as all the other ones. And so we have a real essential task to create in our students the ability to manage information in ways that are really going to be productive to them. So that's some of what I think underlies this. So we're going to be talking more specifically about rigor and relevance and learning strategies. I'm going to give you a quick lesson in rigor and relevance, okay? I normally spend much more time with this. But on the rigor side, I'm talking about Bloom. Okay, and I'm talking about moving from, you know, lower order thinking skills up to higher order thinking skills. That's rigor. Okay? And most of you are very familiar with these various elements, so I'm not going to spend much time there. But at the same time, it's about not simply using information in more complex ways in school, but it's about how do we utilize information in life. And that brings us to the relevant side, the real-world application of information. Now, to me, relevance has two dimensions. One, it means using information in ways that mimic the way information is used in the real world, because we live in kind of this artificial world of schools. So that's sort of one aspect of it. But the other thing is really making information and thinking more student-centered than teacher-centered, because one of the aspects is that kids are disconnected from themselves as learners, in large part because they not only don't see the value of what they're doing in school for the real world, but they also don't understand how they learn. Because frequently, we guide their learning in such highly prescribed manners that they're just following a recipe. So to me, relevance also refers to the idea that kids are going to have to wrestle with constructing meaning, figuring out what strategy to use, figuring out how to apply it. And quite frankly, I think this is most important among our struggling kids, because a lot of them may be struggling for reasons that have to do with engagement as opposed to skills. This is just an example of lack of engagement. This was a question from National Assessment of Educational Progress. It was a math question for 8-9. Cruise ship carrying 200 passengers. Each lifeboat carries 30 passengers. How many lifeboats will the ship need? One-third of the kids answered 6, remainder 20. See? They're just going through the drill. They're not thinking about what they're doing. So we really need to put kids in charge of their learning. This is the relevance side. The kids need to know, what am I learning? Why am I learning it? Most importantly, how can I use it? And another question I think we never really put to them is, how can I work with the teacher, work with each other, to improve the quality of the teaching and learning and what's going on here? See, those are the questions that were always up on my board as a teacher, up on the bulletin board, and that's what I hammered away at. So that's the relevant side, because we really want to give kids opportunities to think the way people in the real world think. And, you know, this is sort of a strange point in a way, because I don't think that artists necessarily problem solve the same way that musicians or mathematicians do. And yet kids don't know that. What do different people read? How do they think? How do they structure their task? How do they make decisions? I mean, do we ever reveal this to kids? See, and I think these are important things we can do. So let's just take a look at this rigor and relevance framework, okay? On the vertical axis, we have the rigor. This is Bloom again, and we're moving from lower order thinking like knowledge and comprehension up to higher order thinking like analysis, evaluation, synthesis, things like this. And we're just going to sort of arbitrarily draw a line here between lower and higher order thinking, okay? I mean, this is not exactly accurate. It's just representative. Then on the relevance side, we're going to talk about, on the left, this kind of low relevance. You know, it's very school-centered, highly prescribed by teachers, doesn't seem to have a lot of real-world application. On the right, it's very student-based. Kids have got to figure it out. Certainly mimics what's going on in the real world, and you end up with 4 possible intersection points. For example, you get Quadrant A, which is lower order thinking done in a very highly prescribed school setting. And this is a lot of what happens in school, right? It's all about getting the content. And think as teachers how much you've got to teach. And think of those state standards and then the sense, oh my God, we've got to cover the content. And of course, we all know the most efficient way to cover the content is for the teacher to cover it, right? I mean, just deal it out. And I used to teach, you know, world history. Well, actually, I taught European history back in the old days when we didn't even have Afro-Asian or anything. It wasn't a concern at that point. I used to call it Plato to NATO. You know, I just thought, if I could just get to World War II, you know, damn, if I could just get to World War II. So I'd just be trudging, you know, I was just like blasting through this stuff. And I was just washing over the kids. I mean, I was just hammering away here. Okay, Quadrant B. Lower order thinking, but in a much more real world setting. The kids have got to figure it out. It's got real world application. Might be require them to make some decisions, to negotiate with a peer, but again, it's lower order skills, so it's going to stay at the comprehension or the application level. Then quadrant C, which is higher order thinking, but again, in the real world setting. And I taught everything, trust me. I taught co-taught with special ed, I taught AP, I taught it all. And this is where a lot of the AP was. You know, again, very teacher-directed, higher order thinking, but, you know, again, here's what I want you to do. Here's step one, step two, step three. You should get this when you're done. It should look like this. Okay, very highly prescribed. But there is a quadrant D, which again is higher order thinking, but done in a way that really might do one of two things. One is it might mimic how this is done in the real world, which you can sometimes emulate in a classroom setting, you know, without sending the kids out of the building. But more importantly, it's done in a way where kids have to figure out, you know, what strategy am I going to use? How am I going to design this? How am I going to compare things? And so forth. So eventually, this is where I did all my AP teaching. And kids used to tell me not so much just what they learned about the material, but what they learned about themselves as learners. See? So you can make sure, I think, that the assessment matches the instructional goal. I mean, you do not want to teach quadrant D and then assess with a quiz. More importantly, you want to mix a variety of approaches. I did not say, and I do not want to be quoted as ever saying, all the teaching is in quadrant D. No, you got to teach all over the place. But you ought to know why you're there, where you're there. The kids ought to understand Bloom. I mean, your kids should get a lesson in Bloom's taxonomy, and they should be able to tell you at any point what's going on from the level of Bloom. Why wouldn't you do that? Shouldn't they be empowered to know about different levels of thinking? So it's best to mix a variety of approaches. Unfortunately, in quadrant A, we as teachers end up doing most of the work. See, early on in my career, what I used to think about is, what am I going to do with the kids this week? That was always the question. In fact, I still have trouble sleeping on Sunday nights. I don't know why, but it's always like my lessons aren't good this week. This isn't going to work. Then I went through my phase. That was the Loggins and Messina phase. I had read Teaching as a Subversive Activity, and I was going to set my kids free to learn. And, of course, nothing happened. They said, this is great, man. He doesn't care. Let's hang out. You know. So that didn't work. So then I had to say, wait a minute. I've got to figure out how to create an environment for them to be successful in. See, so actually teaching in these other three quadrants takes as much work. It just happens at a different time. See, this happens in the classroom. Teaching out here happens before class because you are now the designer of a learning environment. You are not the deliverer or the gatekeeper for information. So it's a different type of thing. Now, we need to talk a little bit about literacy. I think literacy is constructing meaning. I mean, that would be the definition that I would use. Okay. And as a content area teacher, we all want our kids to be more literate, even though we're probably not skilled in reading. Now, these are three types of struggling readers. Okay, we've got Brandon on the left who says, I can't understand this assignment. Lauren says, I can read it, but I don't know what it says. And Tevin who says, why would anyone want to read this garbage? Okay, the kinds of comments that you sometimes get from kids. Okay, and for some reason, this doesn't want to go to next. Excuse me. There. One of the things I've tried to do on this website, Content Reading Strategies That Work, is I've tried to provide teachers with specific strategies they can use for different types of readers. So, for example, if you have a reader like, we'll say, Lauren, who says, I can read it, but I don't understand it, she might be what we would call a word caller. In other words, she can decode, and she can actually read in a kind of proficient fashion. She just doesn't understand what she reads. So you can actually go to my website and you can read more about students like Lauren, who's a word caller, and then you can download tools as PDFs. You can just hit print, and there's a teacher's toolbox, and there's also a student material that you can print or adapt if you want, and give to the students. And there's a whole host of different strategies. So we're going to go kind of quickly today, but there's a lot more online that you can go get because we don't have time to do them all. Question, do I have to become a reading teacher? No, you don't. But I think there are things that you can do in your content area which will support kids in terms of developing their literacy skills. One of the curious statistics that I saw, not only is the highest failure rate in high schools Algebra 1, but after pregnancy, it's the leading indicator of high school dropout rate. It's got the second highest correlation of any other factor. But interestingly enough, the leading indicator of success in Algebra 1 is the score on English 8. So let's put this together, you see? And so as Doug Reeves said, Algebra 1 test is a reading test with numbers. And you know what? All our tests have become a science test with numbers. A reading test with science. Okay, let me get that right. All the tests are reading tests now. So whether you want to be a reading teacher or not, if you're going to be successful with your kids, you're going to have to use some strategies because we all rely on reading. We cannot get away from it. Now, one of the things that I'll be really pressing, and I know most of you are here as teachers, and we've got some administrators too, some. You're kind of in some teams. You've come here as teams to think about things. You really need to go back and start to talk about how do we organize ourselves as a team. I mean, for example, can we work together across a discipline so we know the terms we're teaching in math and the vocabulary that we're teaching in social studies and give kids opportunities to match those things up? Or even a better example I saw, there was a middle school math teacher and a middle school music teacher that got together to teach fractions using musical notation. Okay? See, we have to know what we're doing in other disciplines. And frankly, as a teacher, I never knew what was going on in other teachers' classrooms. I didn't even know what was going on in other social studies classrooms, much less what was going on in the math classroom. So I'm going to be putting in a plug for this. Now, one of the things we have to do is we really have to help our kids set a purpose for reading. Many of the districts that I've worked with, one of the suggestions that I've made and I've gotten feedback from that's been very positive over time has to do with helping kids know how to set a purpose for their reading. When you and I read something, we have all sorts of reading styles. I mean, you've got that flip-through look at it, which is rather cursory. If you're at the airport and you're trying to make a connecting flight, you might spend a minute and a half reading gate number, time, whatever, city, and very intently. Okay, our kids don't understand what the purpose is for reading. One of the suggestions that I've made that schools have taken me up on is why don't we have a common form, a standardized form that we used in our building or in our department where we did a little checkoff box for kids, and as we gave out a reading to kids, they understood what they were supposed to get out of it and what they were looking for and what the purpose was and what the structure was. Because kids don't understand, especially struggling readers, do not understand the purpose of what they're doing. We're going to focus in on three strategies, and I'm going to do these very quickly. I usually do these for a day or two. So this is very cursory. Three strategies, clusters, which I think are very significant. One is defining, summarizing, and comparing. And I'm going to use the rigor and relevance model to show you how this works. Now, by defining, I mean negotiating meaning. And I do mean negotiate. Notice I do not use the word vocabulary. It's about a defining strategy. Because, see, typically defining is a quadrant A activity where you look this up in your glossary and put it in your notebook. But, see, I think there are ways to move this out into the other quadrants. And that's what I think ought to be happening. I was looking for an example of poor word choice, and I saw this one, which I thought was pretty good. If you can't read this, it says, for restrooms, go back toward your behind. You know, there's these really wonderful translations. I was actually just in London until, like, yesterday, so I was reading some of the British signage, you know. Mind the gap, you know. You're supposed to step out of the subway. You mind the gap. I like that one. Strategies for teaching defining skills. Two essential areas. One is, how do you connect the new vocabulary with prior knowledge? How is it introduced? most importantly, how do kids have opportunities to sort of connect it with what they already know? And then a second area is, do you give kids opportunities to more deeply process it? So those are the kind of the two that I'm going to go through rather quickly. Let's start with the associations with prior knowledge. See, I think one of the things we frequently do not do is we do not give kids opportunities to kind of struggle with defining it before the glossary comes out, before the dictionary comes out. You know, have you ever heard this word? What's it sound like? Can you generate a preliminary definition? Okay. Especially working in tandem with other kids. Can you compare the similarities and differences between them? Again, before the dictionary comes out. Perhaps adding some sort of graphic organizer where kids might look at some aspect of, you know, do I really know this word? Again, another strategy, and by the way, I didn't say this at the beginning, but these are not original things. I mean, this is stuff that a lot of you already do. So hopefully this is just a brief little catalyst to sort of say, oh yeah, I remember that, I used to use it, or I've got a better one, I've got to try that. But the list group label, give them a word, we'll say, like revolution, and then give them some time to say, I want you to jot down all the things that you associate with this word, and then either working individually or in small groups, I want you to group the words into some common clusters, and then once grouped, I want you to decide on a label for each one. See, this is giving kids an opportunity to look at the dimension of meaning before the glossary comes out. But then, of course, they need opportunities to really explore the words and internalize them. Again, and this takes some time. But thinking about ways to structure that. For example, certainly use of graphic organizers. And I just stuck a whole bunch of different ones in here. But this is one that looks at related and opposite words, perhaps a way of remembering the word. Here's another one that looks at the word parts. Again, you could have a whole host of these graphic organizers that kids might choose from. Looking at opportunities for them to design or draw a definition. That's a very powerful tool. Many of our kids are much better at visual learning than they are at some sort of text-based learning. Perhaps something like the Frayer model, where students not only define and give characteristics, but they give examples and non-examples. See, what something isn't can be just as illuminating as what it is, especially when kids get an opportunity to put it in their own words. And then finalizing it by asking them to make connections. What have they learned about the word? How has it evolved? How is it their thinking or their understanding? How could they connect it with something in their personal life? This is the essential portion of this. Now, of course, the critical question then becomes, what sort of words are we using with kids? For example, does your school have an agreed-upon common academic vocabulary list? Or is every teacher teaching their own? Now, some of the districts that I've worked with have started doing this. This is just an example from one, and this was the word of the day. This is the middle school. And what I especially liked about this is they used a Latin root each week, even though they weren't teaching Latin. So, for example, this week of the fourth, the Latin root was durare. And then they did endure, endurance, durable, and duration. And every day, in every class, teachers used the word endurance. And you know what? That year, those kids learned 180 words really well. But more importantly, they also learned that if they understood endure, they might be able to, on their own, construct the meaning of durable. So they learned about the whole notion of root words, and they learned to start thinking through before the dictionaries came out. And then, of course, one of the things that our kids struggle with is our kids that don't have a deep base of background knowledge don't learn as fast as the others, but there is a lot of research that shows that effective learning strategies can construct background knowledge. I mean, we are not stuck with kids that are doomed to be forever behind because they lack the background knowledge that some of their peers have. Now, of course, we have to monitor this, but again, I like things to be more student-centered than teacher-centered. And, of course, if you're going to spend more time Because let's face it, it's much quicker to get out the glossary list and say, here's the words you have to know by next week, or here's the words for this unit, and all the things I just showed you take time. Okay. But nonetheless, over time, they become sort of student-centered. I'd like to see the monitoring of the progress be equally student-centered. Why not an approach to tracking vocabulary progress? Why not give kids their own self-evaluative rubric to evaluate their understanding of the word? So that, for example, over the course of the week, they were self-evaluating how many words they knew at level 3, level 4, level 2, etc. Again, turning over the learning to them. Kids want to learn language. I mean, just look at rap music. I mean, it's all about new language. So they're hungry to learn new terms. I think, and I've done this in a very cursory fashion, these workshops are only an hour, you know, I've tried to at least suggest to you in this amount of time that there are ways to get defining out of quadrant A and out into some of these other quadrants, which are much more student-centered, perhaps require more analytic thinking. Let's take a brief look at summarizing. Summarizing, to me, is about synthesis and judgment. Answering the question, what's important? Again, very easy for summarizing to be in quadrant A. I want you to get the main ideas from the reading. They go copy down the bullet points, you know, the boldface, right? Just copy. So all he wants me to do is copy the boldface. I can do that. There. I don't know what it means, but it was bold, so I've got it. So we want to get the kids out into the other quadrants. Now, there's a good reason for this, and this is research shows that students that go through a summarizing activity have over a third gain in their mastery of the content. So we're not just doing it for the fun of it. It works. So kids summarizing will improve their content mastery. Now, one of the things that I try and stress is the whole idea that text summarizing is really no different as an intellectual process from doing a visual summary or an auditory summary. I mean, answering these three questions intellectually are all the same thing. And since kids may have some good listening skills and some good visual skills, we can segue from there. In fact, I would submit that if you took six essential critical thinking skills we wanted kids to have, identify details, recognizing context, identify relationships, opinions, infer meaning, make predictions, these could be done equally as well whether you were reading something, looking at something, or listening to something. So why not explore some different modalities with kids to give them the intellectual experience of inferring meaning or identifying context, so that they could then transfer that skill to their reading? I mean, this is a visual summary. This is one that our coach is doing for us, okay? Observe and summarize. This is another technique that I love. This guy, Roger Essley, who I've worked with in our district, has this technique called telling boards. In New York State, where I'm from Rochester, New York, I forgot to mention that. New York State standards say the kids on the ELA test have a listening section. So the kids are listening to a passage that's read to them. We found that kids, picking up on Roger's thinking, some of our kids were better, instead of taking notes, were better at drawing pictures. So this is the actual work of a student. I'm going to give you kind of a rough version of what they were read. It was a little more detailed than this. But Josephine Dixon married Earl Dixon, who was a cotton buyer, and Josephine occasionally hurt herself in the kitchen, and Joseph was always was always very attentive to tend and help her. And at the time, he used to use both cotton and tape, and then he put it together. And so Earl got the idea that he could put the cotton on the tape ahead of time, and then she could perhaps take care of things herself. And he happened to work for Johnson & Johnson, and he pitched the idea to them, and they created Band-Aids, made lots of money, and Earl got to be the vice president of Johnson & Johnson. Now, what's interesting is we started working with our teachers and our students in this technique, and we found that their level of comprehension skyrocketed. Curiously enough, what we really noticed the difference was, if we asked kids to do a pictogram of what they were going to write before they wrote it, you know, the typical assignment, you know, we want you to write something. We asked them to storyboard it ahead of time. The quality of the writing skyrocketed because kids organize their thinking visually before they try to capture it in text. So again, I'm just trying to make the pitch that, you know, visual skills overlap with writing skills. There's a lot of dialoguing kids can do. I'm sure you've done like a paired reading where student one reads to student two and student two does the summary. Or something like a paired reading coach model where maybe the teacher has some guiding questions. One of the teachers is, quote, the coach, another student's a reader, and a summarizer summarizes based on the questions from the teacher. You can increase the relevance by making a collaborative summary, okay? You guys read something, you read the same thing, you now have to negotiate a summary between you or among you. For example, to just structure this, all four kids read the same item, they come up with the main idea, one and two pair into pair A, they have to negotiate it, pair B does, eventually all four have to synthesize it into one idea, and then perhaps do a free write explaining what they've learned for perhaps some kids that were not there to read it. Okay? Always asking the open-ended question, what's going on here and what do you see that makes you think so? See, that's something I would hammer away at kids, whether they're listening to something, reading something, what's happening here and what is it in the text? What is it in the diagram? What is it in the image? What is it in that painting? Why do you think that's the case? Because, see, that's at the essence of synthesis and judgment, and that's at the essence of summarizing skills. Okay? And then I think, you know, I do workshops on just discussion skills. I mean, lots of teachers have great discussion group techniques with their kids. Others don't. I mean, if I said to some of you, put your kids in a fishbowl, you might not know what I'm talking about. Your kids might not know what I'm talking about. And yet districts where I've worked with where the teachers use common discussion group techniques, you can go into one of those classrooms with a group of 7th or 8th graders and the teacher said, okay, we're going to get into a fishbowl, and guess what? They get into it because they know what a fishbowl is and they know what the roles are. So again, a pitch I would make, find some strategies that work for you, work with the teachers on your team and your department and your building, mirror them at faculty meetings instead of somebody reading a memo to you. I mean, get up there and try it. Okay? And then, of course, ultimately, I think you can segue this to text-based things. Again, a lot of kids don't know what you mean when you say summarize. I get it down to delete, substitute, and keep. And we put kids through exercises to start to do that. Another, I think, very important point is kids don't know anything about text structure. For that matter, if you're a social studies teacher, you might not have thought much about text structure. And see, one of the reasons kids can't summarize is they cannot envision the structure of what their reading is. Now, I'm sure most of you by now have sort of figured out the structure of my talk, right? He's here to pitch this essential idea of rigor and relevance. He's going through defining, summarizing. I think he said he's going to go to comparing next. So you get the talk. You know what I'm talking about. Kids don't understand how text is structured. And frequently as teachers, we don't take the time to describe that to them. So question I would put out there, does your school use some common strategies to map text structure? Do you even talk about text structure? Have your teachers who are content people that are not reading people, have they been specifically instructed in how to recognize text structure? See, I think there's probably 5 text structures you could use. Description, comparison, cause and effect, problem, solution, sequence. I mean, you can use continuity and change. I mean, there's a few more out there, but virtually anything a kid reads is going to be one of these. So why not teach them what the description is and then what the cue words are so when they encounter their text, they say, oh, this is cause and effect. And not only that, but why not have a text structure organizer that goes along with each text structure? So if you're talking about giving kids skills to summarize, this scaffolds that because they're getting some training in the text structure and there's a text structure organizer to utilize. Some of the places I've worked, I go back and they've actually, one I was very impressed with, actually had a contest among the kids to design text structure organizers which the kids did. This was a middle school. And then the winners, which was peer-reviewed by other kids, got to be the ones who were put on the notebook or the book covers the following year. So every kid had the same graphic organizers on their notebook covers. They were all designed by students from the prior year. And everyone used them. Okay? Sequence, yeah. Okay. And ultimately, if we're talking about summarizing, we have to give kids some opportunities to talk about evaluating their summaries. So I would ask some critical thinking here, critical questions about the sequence. Is it too narrow? Is it too broad? Would someone else understand this? Audience and purpose, always essential. And most importantly, you know, is this plagiarized or are you doing this in your own words and style? So, what have I tried to do? Well, in a very quick fashion, I've tried to at least get you thinking about moving summarizing out of quadrant A and see how this could be put into the other quadrants. Okay? Finally, let's talk about comparison. And I'll just take a quick look at some comparing strategies. Now, comparison has been shown through the research to be the single most effective learning strategy you can use in your classroom. In other words, if I stood up here and did a lecture on the essential components of nutrition, and then half of the room went off and took a quiz on it, and I asked the other half to go through a comparison activity and then take the same quiz, you'd see 45% gain among this group. It's as simple as that. This is the gold standard for learning strategies, giving kids a chance to compare. Now, typically, you might see something like this. I'm going to teach, you know, regions of the world. It's a science class. It's a geography class. I don't know what it is. Okay. So, I'm going to compare the animals and the climate of the rainforest and the desert. I give them a whole bunch of factors from each. Then I give the kids a graphic organizer, and I'd say, okay, this is desert climate and rainforest climate, and the kid picks the items out that are rainforest only, desert only, the ones that are in both. The kids do the ones for the fauna here, forest, desert, both. Okay. I guess my question to you would be, what quadrant would you put this in? This is our big audience response moment. By the way, our audience response systems that we were going to use here, we had a little problem, so you didn't get to click them, sorry. But come back, we'll get it fixed next time. So where would you put this? How many of you would put this in quadrant A? Raise your hands. We got a few. How about quadrant B? Just a couple? How about C? And D? Okay, so most of you put it up in higher order thinking. Why? They had to do comparison. It's analysis, right? So this is higher order thinking, isn't it? Is it?
It's knowing facts.
Well, which is it? I mean, is this higher order thinking? Is this analysis? Well, see, it sort of depends on how the lesson was structured, right? I mean, it depends. If they were just, if you already taught them where everything goes, then they're just doing an information filing. Let me put the question to you another way. Did the students get to select the information, decide on the categories? I don't know. See, we didn't say. Did they design the graphic organizer? See, because if they didn't do these things, then what they did is they learned where things go. Most importantly, this is the key thing. What's the point of the comparison? What's it enable us to see or do? That's the critical question, right? And did they ever get a hint at that? Now, here's a question for you. What if you said to your kids, you select the geographic regions, you develop the model, you select the factors, you develop the graphic organizer and the way to display your comparison. Could your kids do that? Independently. Just say, next week I want you to come in, I want you to design the comparison, you go find the information, you design the factors, you develop the graphic organizer, etc. I don't know. Some of your kids probably could, some would struggle, yeah.
But if you have a question at the mm-hmm. living there or settling there, a reason to be there for them, for personally.
Yeah.
Then they would create the comparison based on a lot of factors that relate to their own life.
Okay.
And they would be.
Sure, and she's raising the point that if you ask kids where they'd like to live and they could sort of imbue the task with some of them, you know, some of their own feelings, it would be very, very helpful. My point is that I suspect that we've got a lot more work to do to move from giving the kids the sort of pre-canned comparison, here's the strategies, here's the factors, here's the whatever, to giving them the opportunity to design their own. Now, it's also interesting if you think about the kind of jobs they're going to get in the real world. Now, my dad he was a 10th grade dropout, and he got a job at Kodak, and I'm from Rochester, New York, that's home of Kodak, and he faithfully showed up at midnight and worked in the dark, mixing chemicals, following a procedure, never had to think about what he did, he just worked trick work, he worked all these rotating shifts. And you know what? We got to live this kind of okay working class life. I mean, it was okay. I mean, I got to go to college. My brother and sister went to college. Worked. 10th grade education. Okay? Now, let's bring it up to 2006. You've got a 10th grade education. You're going to send 3 kids to college. Is there a job out there for you that what your main, you know, skill is to show up on time and do exactly what you're told? Do you suppose there's a job out there where someone's going to say, no, I want you to come in here. I've got this whole thing figured out. These are exactly the steps I want you to follow. Here's where everything goes, and then I want to see it all here on Friday. Yeah. Who's doing that now? That's being done by a machine, right? I mean, there's some computer doing it or somebody in some other part of the world that's doing it. So my point to you is this. When your kids walk across the stage at graduation, they better be able to do something like this unless you figure it's somebody else's job to teach them this. But see, I think it's our jobs as educators, and I know we've got some middle school people and some high school people. See, and I think our programs need to flow one into the next, and this kind of process has to start back at the elementary level, at the intermediate level, up in fourth, fifth, sixth grade. That's where it's got to start, okay? Because we have to give kids opportunities. If they're really going to take advantage of the highest level of thinking, it's because they design their own comparisons. And, you know, there's ways to start them doing this and very interesting things to them, very relevant, very independent kinds of subject matter that you could pick. I mean, you could pick a question on sports. You know, you could give them this very simple question. Which is better, Tuesday's lunch or Wednesday's? I mean, let them figure it out. Let them design the comparison. What's it on price, nutrition, whatever. Let them figure it out, because that's where the learning's going to take place. Okay? And where it especially takes place is when you move them from comparing to classifying. See, that to me is the highest level of kind of thinking that kids could do, where you give them material and you start to give them opportunities to figure it out. You know, we're forever telling people what they can and cannot compare. And what we don't think about is the fact that, you know, comparisons have an underlying classification system that we may not have ever revealed to kids. See, I think we want to move kids from simply applying someone else's application of a classification to actually developing and designing their own. Because that's where real learning is going to take place. Because they have to start answering some questions. If I'm going to classify this information, then, you know, what's alike, what's different, why, what's the function of it, how's it fit, what doesn't fit. I mean, that's where learning. I mean, start something really simple. Give them a pile of buttons and tell them to classify those. You know, do a periodic table of buttons and let them design it. You know, this is a great strategy. I walked into a middle school classroom. The teacher was doing a list group label, and the kids had to do all the word associations with something, put it on a Post-it, and then they went up in teams and they placed the Post-its on the board, and then they had to circle the group of Post-its and give it a label. This is a classification exercise. Did not take very long. It was a very worthwhile learning experience for the kids. You can actually wed classification to evaluation. Give them a decision to make. Here's a decision. Here's three possible options. Here's some criteria for evaluation to get at the best decision. I mean, this is Consumer Reports, right? Right? I mean, they compare something. They develop a system. Give them something like choosing a career, picking a college, best skateboard. Who cares? Let them figure it out. Let them negotiate in their groups how they're going to quantify and represent each of those intersection points. That's where the learning is going to take place. Here's just a very simple exercise. Again, we haven't had much time, but I sort of tossed this one out. Used to give kids opportunities to do content analysis. This all started, a couple girls were telling me one day, this was ninth graders, they said, you know, Mr. Pappas, these girls' magazines are all about being pretty and popular. They're really not about being a better person. And I said, well, prove it to me. They kind of looked at me. I said, prove it. I want to know how many articles about being popular and pretty and how many articles about being a better person. So they went back and they had to develop a system to go into the magazines. And I thought, man, this is a great learning experience. So I kind of used it over and I turned it into other things. But I mean, they basically had to look at the types of articles, how to categorize them, how to organize the information, frequency of categories, length of story. I mean, they had to figure this all out themselves. And they had a ball doing it. So that became kind of an activity that I developed. I mean, letting kids go in and observe and categorize. And you know what? This is at the heart of science. This is the heart of being a good coach, knowing what the other teams are doing. Again. And then being able to explain why they're interested, how they gathered their data, how they represent it graphically, how they answered their research question, what they learned from the project. Again, very relevant. What did you get out of this? Okay? So again, I think there's a lot of work we can do. I think there's a lot of work you can do as teachers to turn the learning over to the kids. I strongly urge you, if you want to go download some ideas, go to this website. Otherwise, just check this out. Go to the blog. You'll get an update of today's talk. Hopefully, my tape recorder worked. And I want to thank you all very much. I've got a couple more shows, so stop back another time. Take care.
Bookstore yesterday. Have you ever been there?
Powell's?
You have to go there.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
On Burnside. It's a block, a city
oh,
block.
Oh, great.
And like three stories.
Well,
I was looking for help on teaching Latin and Greek to middle school kids.
Oh, really?
The prefixes, the roots,
oh, yeah.
The suffixes. And then you just plop that up there and it's like so neat. Is that from something?
That what? That,
that root? Where the calendar the, and then the parts?
No, we just figured it out. Yeah. I sort of dumped a lot of ideas on you today. I mean, it wasn't real.
But they're good. I've been teaching Bloom's Taxonomy to my healthy living class for 2 years.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
So that was fun to hear, too. But
well, thanks.
Well, so that is it from me. I just have to get my own.
Yeah, I wish I hadn't all worked out for you.
You mentioned that there's a 50% overlap with the academic one this afternoon. Should I go to the website and get the information?
Well,
that?
You know, I sort of should come I? In it a different way. It's up to you. I mean, I guess it's up to what else is going on and what you want to do. I use the same essential approach of define, summarize, compare. I tend to use different examples. Some of them are the same. Some are different. I model it a different way.
This is extremely valuable.
Good. Good.
I will take it back to my whole team.
Great.
And my whole building.
Great.
Thank you.
Take care.
I've got other pens. I'm going to give you yours back.
What a good baby.
It would have taken me years to turn.
How you doing, Bunny?
You doing good, baby boy?
Did you learn a lot today?
Yes, he did. He knows all kinds of stuff.
Great. Oh, that's you. I thought you were unplugging me. I only heard one peep out of him.
It was in the last session, too. So
I know.
Pretty good.
How old?
I just held a 3-day old the other day, and it's amazing. Well, I was telling his mom how much they can change in just, a couple of months. The eyes are so much more.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Enjoy.
Thank you. Hope you're enjoying the Northwest.
Well, I got in. Actually, I was in London. I just flew in from London, so I got here last night, and I was a little. Crazed. It was like, is it midnight or is it 4 p.m?
Are you going to be around for a day or two?
Yeah. I'm here tonight and tomorrow night, and then I fly out whatever the next day is. So, yeah, you got any recommendations for restaurants or anything around here? I mean, give me something to go to.
But it depends on your interests.
Well, how about sushi or something?
Well, you probably know better for sushi.
I think I can stop taping this.